This is our third, and I suppose because I'm leaving in a matter of hours, it will be our last session as well. And I kind of left a lot of loose ends from our last taping session on Saturday. I suppose a way to try to repair some of that or bring it together is to start with a more general theme that you were discussing, and that was the work that was being done by people, not probably just at University of Minnesota, but elsewhere as well, which was concerned with the effects of treatment and the chances and the prognoses for secondary malignancies because of chemo and radiotherapy. And I guess the one thing that was always the largest or the most concern with were alkalizing agents, which I assume is part of the chemo. Mm-hmm. therapy. So perhaps a more general kind of almost history or overview would one help me ask more intelligent and particular questions, but also give you a chance perhaps to talk about it and your view of this kind of work and your involvement in it.
Right. Well, this was it's kind of an important area. It still is a very important area. For one reason is because patients are living longer with cancer, and so it's more of a concern about how we treat these patients, whereas before we just wanted to do what we could with them. Now we want to make sure that they have a long, if they are cured, that they have a long, healthy life afterwards. So it's been important, and it's been a big concern for everybody from that point of view. And also it may be an interesting thing to study, because you have because usually when patients come in with cancer, they hadn't been followed medically before that point in time, and so you don't really know what happened to them, you don't know what they were exposed to, you don't know why they got cancer in the first place, whereas these patients had already been treated for one malignancy, so they were usually under regular medical care and surveillance, and you had an idea of what might be causing the cancer, so it gave a model for the causation of cancer to study in human beings rather than in animals or in test tubes or whatever else. So it was a human model of carcinogenesis that was right before your eyes. And by studying that, it might give us some understanding of how cancer comes about. So those were the two reasons why a lot of people were really interested in this, even though it could be considered to be a relatively rare occurrence.
Now, I get the... So that we had also discussed some statistics, and I cannot substantiate mine, and I thought a thorough enough job looking for it that I'm just wrong, and we'll take it at that, and my apologies. I was still curious about, and maybe asking the question in a more intelligent and more informed fashion, the notion of treating people with agents that are known to be carcinogenic themselves or perhaps to have some sort of carcinogenic effect on people. As you said, as far as you know, especially with children, 2% is a good rough estimate of the kind of for people who will have some long-term effect from initial treatments for a primary cancer diagnosis. I take it there was always the knowledge that something like this could be a result, that the payoff for those chances were still pretty clearly set in the other 98% who would probably receive some benefit from that treatment, which is either a longer life, even if it or prolonged, even if it did not put them in total remission. So that they would end up, dying of some other cause. And I was wondering, had it been, in a sense, until, let's say, the 70s, perhaps, late 60s, had it been something that was watched and kind of followed through, or was this really just something that people finally realized they had to, with the success rates they were having in with remission, but they needed to start following this?
Yeah, it only was recognized. The concern was probably always there, but it only was recognized when people started living. Somewhere around the 60s, 70s, people started developing a real awareness of it happening.
So there was a period of time where chemo and radiotherapy was being used, and the results were rather iffy, or rather the remission wasn't occurring. There was just maybe a prolongation of life for a year or two or something like that.
For a month or two, or a week or two, or whatever.
And yeah. It was still seen, though, as really the only... that the treatment was still worth doing because it might lead to something else. In other words, you were learning, in a sense, by treating people, what the treatment was doing over time.
Right.
And I know this is kind of before you were practicing medicine and whatnot. I'm just trying to, again, get a sense of how the medical community would weigh such issues as... these and come up with a plan of action. It seems to be pretty consistent use of these kinds of therapies over time in different places, and as a matter of fact, a frequent thing that one notices in the notes to these articles is the different kinds of protocols that are used, and they seem to be pretty much the same or within certain bounds. Is that a good...
I don't know what you mean by the protocols being the same. But
the kinds of treatments that were being done, and I think they have titles to them. I mean, the NIH issues guidelines. I guess that's what I'm... protocols is not the right word. And that most people follow them. Or that, for instance, I think the University of Chicago is even cited somewhere as having set up guidelines and limits, if you will, for treatment of such cases. And that those are important points to discuss in a more general discussion of long-term effects of such treatment, is knowing exactly what kind of guidelines were used and how that person was treated, and with how soon after diagnosis and things like this.
Actually, the NIH doesn't really issue guidelines like that.
Okay.
The way therapy evolves is just basically in the literature,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A series of studies that go on in the literature, and every time a new study comes out, it's compared with whatever else has been available before that, and at some point, and it's a changing thing, different therapies become accepted as the standard,
mm-hmm.
of care. And the NIH hardly ever issues
specific guidelines. Again, I could perhaps turn off the tape recorder and try to go through this and find an example.
Now, sometimes the Food and Drug Administration will issue a warning if they learn about some danger of a particular drug.
Mm-hmm.
They may issue some kind of warning that goes out to all physicians. But various therapies become the standard of care based on the literature and based on existing practices,
mm-hmm.
and it's much less formal than you would think.
Okay. Maybe a good way then again to pursue this is to get a sense of how you make judgments about these sorts of treatments, and how, for instance, this research that you've now pursued for which is about 10, 11 years has affected the way that you diagnose and treat children with cancer. Again, what I'm trying to get at, and I'm not sure that I am, is to just try to get some, find a way for you to respond to, I think, just the whole general area of how the research affects what you're doing and the practice of medicine, and how it affects the quality, I guess, of your patients' lives, and how you do that. I'm not sure I know of a good way to get that kind of a response. Should we talk about one particular patient? Should we talk about some of these studies you've done and perhaps how they've altered your modus operandi? And I guess that's what I would try to say is what I'm getting at. And again, I don't know that I have enough of a background to pull the particulars out and kind of need your help on that.
Well, one thing is I'm not really sure whether it has really changed things that much. It's maybe raised a level of concern, but I'm not sure whether it's progressed far along enough to make a definite, clear-cut change in the way it's practiced. Certainly not my own work alone, but if you take all the work together that's been done on this, people now avoid the agents that it's pretty clear that they're associated with secondary cancer, like the class of drugs called alkylating agents. They're still used a lot. But
And what would be the justification for that? When, again, I'm convinced, if I heard of a doctor treating me or someone next that I knew with such a with that kind of treatment, I might at least sit down with them and have a talk with them about it, or try to find out more about it, or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Why would people, is it a matter of a kind of a last resort? Well, this should, you know, again, offer some sort of prolongation of life and an improvement in the quality of life for a patient, even if should this patient actually go into remission to such an extent that this person's life is going to be extended much farther than either the doctor or the patient thought, there may be some trouble down the road.
Well, the drugs are the drugs have been studied a lot in terms of their effect on the tumor cure rate, and if there's not any known alternative, you can't just say this drug's no good, let's take another one and use it. Then you'd be taking a drug that hasn't been studied at all, mm-hmm. and be telling a patient, well, we're just going to give you a drug, we have no idea whether it's going to cure your cancer or not. Mm-hmm. You can't do that, because you have to take the drug that you know that's going to give the patient a 50% cure rate, mm-hmm. and tell the patient that there's a 2% chance that if you live, that you might get a second cancer, mm-hmm. and that might kill you.
But
the benefits are almost always clearly outweigh the risks.
Okay.
And we're used to taking risks, and we tell the patients all the risks. Mm-hmm. The patients undergo a tremendous amount of risk. The second cancer is only one of them. It's the most serious one, but they go through tremendous numbers of risks to their health, mm-hmm. including brain development if it's a child, growth, effects on any organ that could be serious, could be life threatening, could affect their future life. And I think the patients always know that. When they're getting the drugs, it's scary for them. There's a tremendous amount of risk associated with it, but that the benefits outweigh the risks by a fairly large margin.
Okay.
And it's only when it gets to be a situation where there isn't a very large margin between the risk and the benefit that it's really maybe not a good practice. But in the meantime, it's important to continually study and try and make it. Reduce the risks as much as possible. Find new drugs that don't have those risks, or find new ways to protect the patients against the risks. But when you're faced with a life-threatening cancer, then you, the patients have to accept the risks.
Okay. Maybe one way again of looking at how the medical community kind of evaluates these things, and then makes recommendations. Again, you say it's rather, there's nothing necessarily formal about this. A doctor doesn't sign up for something and say, we will never do this way again, we will do it this way, because either a governmental agency or some part of the AMA makes you do that or anything like that. It's really probably done, my guess is almost by hospital or study by study basis, and the people you work with are all familiar with the literature. You all have learned opinion to offer, and perhaps decisions are made at that level as well as to how people will be treated. Perhaps this one of the earlier studies you did, this one on retinoblastoma, and this retrospective analysis is a particularly good way to look at how things are done. And actually, as I said off tape, I don't necessarily want to go through the paper page by page or anything, but if you could explain for me what you saw as the intent and the purpose of doing the work, and then its results.
Okay, well, when I was at the University of Minnesota, we saw quite a few patients with retinoblastoma, and most people believe that patients with retinoblastoma do very well, and the cure rate's 90% if you remove the affected eye. And just during the three-year period that I was at Minnesota, we saw quite a few patients that had that didn't do well, that even though their eye was removed, the tumor came back.
In the same basic area, in other words, it affected the same area of the eye. I mean, the eye's been removed, I realize, but that same area of the head, right, or the other eye, or something like that, or
no, it either regrew in the orbit where the eye was taken out, or it was metastatic to the bone or the bone marrow or some distant site, so, or to the brain. I mean, it wasn't necessarily in the same area.
Okay.
But the tumor came back in some way that usually was pretty much incurable. And we were really disturbed by that, and it didn't fit with what most people said about retinoblastoma. So we decided to look back at our own experience with retinoblastoma and try and analyze the different factors that might be associated with relapse. And so what we did was we pulled out the old charts of the 75 patients that we had seen in the previous like 25 years, and studied the charts in detail to see what kind of characteristics the patients had at diagnosis and what kind of treatment they received and what happened to them. And by studying it carefully like that, we found that the relapse rate was fairly high. It was about, I think, 36% or something. And that was fairly high. And for us, that meant, at least in Minnesota, that we needed to treat the patients more aggressively, so that patients that had risk factors that we identified for relapse, that we would take those patients and do more than just to remove their eye, but maybe to give them some chemotherapy in addition to that, or to monitor them very, very carefully at least. So it did change our practices quite a bit in Minnesota. And we published a paper that described our own experience with it. But whether other people took on any information out of that, or whether they said, well, this is a fluke, people from Minnesota have a different experience than we do, and we're not going to change anything that we're doing. I'm sure there were some hospitals that did that. And there might have been other hospitals that said, gee, we've seen a lot of relapses as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe we ought to look at our own patients, or maybe we should adhere to this more aggressive policy of treatment as well.
There would be a way to kind of get an idea of how those things are done. Have you been in a situation where, in going through the literature, you're presented with something that's different? I mean, you're still familiar with what is going on with this child, and you look at, but you go back to the literature because you need to find out more about something, and you find something that's very current that says, we did this study, we looked at this, and really the kind of status quo treatment is not very good, or we think you need to do this instead, and here are the reasons. Even if, let's say, their statistics or their findings are based on a small sampling, as you seem to feel that yours was in this retinoblastoma study, there wasn't a large enough group to kind of make the results you're finding really stable in a statistical sense. Can you think of an instance, perhaps, where you have changed your practice quite quickly and quite finally because of something you've read in the literature? Or come across it, and it doesn't even have to be in reading it at a meeting or something like that. In other words, how do you perceive what you're doing here, let's just say at University of Chicago, you and the other people in hematology oncology, with these kinds of, as you say, it's not formal, it's a rather informal way in which these decisions are made. Is it a matter of just keeping up with the literature and constantly changing and tinkering with things, or does that happen kind of in fits and starts?
Well, there's a lot of tinkering, but the fact is that most patients, most children with cancer are treated on a national protocols. A whole bunch of hospitals get together across the country and form a group, a cooperative group.
Okay.
And they have meetings, and they get together, and they write protocols that everyone's approved of and participate in.
Okay.
So that, it happens, but it happens on a much... in a much larger scale with a whole lot of patients.
Okay.
So that we learn things very quickly, rather than just tinkering around at individual hospitals.
Okay, yes, that seems to me a rather formal process, whether it's the government forcing you to do that, or the AMA requiring you to do that, or it's voluntary. And perhaps it's better with pediatric cancer than it is with, I don't know, anything, any other, with any other aspects of medicine. But that seems to me quite a formal, again, if voluntary, procedure.
Yeah, well, it's completely done in the context of research. No one's telling anyone how to treat patients or give them the standard of care. What's being done is the best people get together and design the best possible treatment protocol that they can think of, and then they test it. And that's the end of it. And then a paper is written. And people either, after that either do it, they accept that as the standard of care, or they don't do it. They're not telling anybody to do anything in particular. They're doing a study for the purpose of finding better treatments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is it and then as an example, do you usually follow, especially when, you know, pretty radical or pretty clear recommendations are made for changing a way something is done, do you usually adopt that? It's a matter of a wait and see. Do you wait for other hospitals to do that? Do you start immediately doing those kinds of changes yourself and monitoring what the changes accomplish or don't accomplish and reporting back? Or is this just always a constantly?
It really changes. There's always a new question. Once one question is answered, then we go on to the next question. But most people, I would say, probably adhere to it with these cooperative groups, because the cooperative groups are studying huge numbers of patients from a lot of hospitals. So it's not like one little local hospital like Minnesota coming up with their own experience, but it's, you know, across the country. Okay. So most people do adhere to it. But sometimes people don't believe in it, believe in the results. They think the results are wrong, or that they think that it's something that is will be unacceptable to the patient or whatever, and they may not adhere to it, and they might stick with their own.
Do you find that
version of it
happens a lot? Do you think, especially in academic medicine, in an atmosphere as you find here at University of Chicago, are people always open to those kinds of things, or do you find that a lot of that stuff just doesn't get looked at or doesn't get the proper consideration it should? And I don't mean you or your colleagues in your department, but just...
No, I think it gets looked at. Just some questions aren't really clearly answered because they're clinical studies and there's a lot of interpretation involved.
And I know there's no, you know, there'd be a cure for cancer, period, if it was that nice and open and closed and you didn't have any ifs and ands and buts. I realize that. But one thing that did strike me, and something you said in your being attracted to academic medicine versus going into private practice when you finished medical school and your residency and your training and that sort of thing, was that in an academic situation, you would be sitting in a class or you'd see that there was a talk, I forget which, it was the example on strep throat, okay? And you'd learn that the latest thing, and again, we weren't putting this so much in it at the times, you don't necessarily need to treat strep throat right away, then you can do this, the person's got it already, they're going to be sick. And whereas you felt, I guess, that the average GP or somebody in family practice not attached to an academic or a teaching hospital is going to be treating strep throat the way they've been treating strep throat for 20 years or so. And I think that was what you were implying, at least if not coming right out and saying. And so I was curious again about the way that research kind of has an impact on practice and your practice as well as, I guess, more in general. I'd like to get back to the retinoblastoma study again, just to use it as kind of an example with one thing. I also want to say I think that's where I'm confusing my high percentages versus your lows. We're talking about a situation here of relapse, not of relapse because of prior treatment.
Yeah, a relapse is a recurrence of the original disease. A second cancer is a completely new independent cancer.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the
and
first cancer.
Okay, and that's where my confusion is.
Yeah.
This was also, though, a concern of the study was looking at whether this recurrence or relapse was due to prior treatment, and it was the conclusion at this point was that we couldn't tell. It was difficult to say whether the recurrences had to do with prior treatment, or it's just an insidious kind of cancer, and that kind of
we'll be talking about whether the recurrence has occurred because of a lack of prior treatment.
Also,
taking out the eyes wasn't enough. Should we have given them chemotherapy and radiation therapy as well to prevent them from the disease from coming back?
Okay, right.
But there's another issue in the paper about some of the patients did get second cancers.
And that's a much smaller, as you said, it's really much lower. I'm conflating two issues into one. And again, I think we've maybe cleared that up so that we both know what we're talking about, and I hope somebody who's reading this down the road knows what you're talking about, not so much what I'm talking about. I got the sense from reading that paper especially, but other ones as well that you're first author on, that it's all very frustrating. You know, you get to the recommendations, conclusions part, and it's all very, well, we really can't say one way or the other. I want to get a little bit more into this as it relates directly to your research, but I wanted to just preface it with this kind of, I find it kind of across the board. And I think we've discussed a little bit off tape your kind of leaving a lot of the research behind and getting back into the practice of medicine. Instead of picking a particular bit of research for you to have to answer questions about, I guess I'd like to ask you, can you explain or give us an idea of how some of your research has affected your clinical practice? With these rather disappointing results you get from doing your study, one that comes to mind right away is the real intensive study you did on the chromosome translocations, and finally being able to say, well, it's yes, so many of our patients have these chromosome abnormalities, they've translocated to basically the same spot. It's a high enough percentage, I think in one case with adults it's again, I hate to guess percentages now without rifling through my paper and finding, but a quarter to and above. And yet you said this doesn't really help us with prognosis, and we can't make recommendations about treatment. It's great we've got this molecular biological technology. It may be a good way to finally identify specifically certain aspects of chromosome abnormality-related cancers like leukemia. But it doesn't help you much, it seems. I ask, you know, how has this research, even if it's to say it doesn't, how has it affected your practice as a doctor, as a person who cares for people and treats?
What I've done probably hasn't really affected it very much at all. I mean, it's probably just a question of how patient I can be. That it's really important to do the molecular studies and try and understand how cancer works and what cancer is. Because normally what we do is we throw radiation therapy and we throw chemotherapy at patients. And we make them, you know, we push them to the point where they just barely can make it through, because we want to give them as intensive therapy as possible. And it destroys cancer cells, but it also destroys normal cells at the same time. So the patients get severe, serious side effects. But we just throw it at them. They don't have, it's very nonspecific. It's like shooting a shotgun as opposed to taking a bullet and shooting directly at the cancer. It's a shotgun approach. And I think if we understand what cancer is by doing all this molecular biological research and really getting to the point where we really understand it, then people are going to think of completely, totally new ways to treat the cancers. And actually, you know, in the time period that I've been in the field, there's been an incredible amount of molecular biology discovered. I mean, maybe I contributed some to it, but you know, a lot of people have.
And again, how would you? What you were just doing is kind of trying to explain how that fits into treating people and how.
I think the impact so far, in my mind, from this type of work that I do, it hasn't affected treatment basically at all. I mean, in really minor examples of ways that it has, and from that point of view, it's a really delayed.
Okay, we're back on tape. Do you remember where you were? I hope you do, because
the impact is low. So, you know, it takes a long time. It's going to take a long time because the human genome is so complicated, and it turns out cancer is so incredibly complicated. It isn't just one mutation or one gene being affected. There's probably multiple genes. It's very complicated. We don't really understand it yet. We don't even really know whether the human brain is going to be able to understand it. It may be that complicated. But I think it's going to be more like a decade from now when these things are going to make an impact on therapy, where we're not using this shotgun chemotherapy, radiation therapy idea. There have been a few examples where things have been more specific in terms of their treatment, but for the most part... Well, like some patients have been treated with antibodies that are directed at the cancer cells. These things haven't been curative, but I suppose it's, you know, some early step at attempting to direct your therapy at cancer rather than to just throw it at the patient. So, I think it's still going to be another, you know, decade before we see major changes in the way therapy is given. And so from that point of view, what I do now, the lag time between what I do now and change in therapy is a fairly large one. And in addition to that, it's going to take some real, real genius to bring what's happening in the lab to the patient. And I'm not sure whether I feel that I have the vision for that happening. And there may be other people that do. And so I do feel like I've contributed some to the whole process. But I don't feel like I can contribute a lot more right now, in addition to the fact that because my main training is in clinical work.
Mm-hmm.
And my main satisfaction comes out of clinical work. It's got to the point where, you know, without constant gratification in the research area, you know, where things that I've done in the lab have come to fruition, it's hard for me to maintain some, you know, a high enough level of satisfaction to be doing basic laboratory work without the clinical reward. So I think other people are going to have to do that, and I'm sure they will, and they are. And whereas I myself, just for my own personal satisfaction, I'm going to have to get my rewards in the clinical mm-hmm. area.
You say it's going to take a genius to be able to maybe cross this bridge and to have the kind of vision, right, is the word you use, to see how all this rather, I believe at one point in a note you wrote to me, you call it esoteric research, have, you know, what role it's going to play and how you're going to do that research to make it pay off in the way that we take care of people's health and the way that we help them when they're sick. And I guess I'd almost want to play devil's advocate with you and say, actually, isn't it somebody probably, it doesn't need to be a genius so much as somebody who has a very good idea about what treatment is about and what it's supposed to do, but also somebody who has just a very good knowledge and understanding of, let's say, something like the genetic processes that are actually involved in cancers, in our specific example here. In other words, isn't someone like you, or perhaps the cytogenetics group that you're working with here, aren't these the people who are going to be the ones who build that bridge across?
If you're
frustrated by the fact that, well, when you do clinical stuff, you know, somebody smiles, a child smiles at you and appreciates the work you're doing, and it's better for 6 months even, or 6 years, and that's the payoff, and it's pretty regular, and it's probably very nice. It's not even just, look at this beautiful thing I just genetically engineered in the lab. I mean, it has a lot more to do with, I think, a lot of things we've talked about on previous tapes, about your interest in children and what you want to do and how you've really had that vision of doing it since you were, you know, 18 or 19 years old, certainly maybe earlier. But what about the combination of the two, the rather frustrating part of working in a lab and the rewarding part?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that get satisfaction out of doing it mm-hmm. that way. But there are people that are very capable. They're able to keep up their clinical skills, keep up with the clinical literature, keep up in the lab, spend a lot of hours at it.
Okay.
And I don't have that, you know, I have to take care of my family, and I only have so many hours, and so I don't want to split my time between two completely major things.
Mm-hmm.
Two things that require two, you know, what I would consider to be gigantic efforts. You know, one to know how to take care of patients and keep up with that field, and the other to do mm-hmm. very highly competitive molecular biology research. Competing for grants to do that work and keeping up with that literature. Those are two gigantic efforts, and there's a whole lot of people, you know, very, very remarkable people
who are doing
that.
Who is? Can you name, I mean, you know, within your own personal experience?
Oh,
who really are as good a clinician as you are? You know, again, I think we'll get a little bit into it. One of the things in your Pew application that people are very impressed by is your abilities to have picked up, with that very little background, some molecular biological techniques and apply them elsewhere. I mean, that's pretty creative. Brilliant, even, I guess, is a word that somebody used. So without calling you a genius or stroking your ego too much, somebody certainly at least thought, and quite a few people thought, you certainly were one of those people. We can get into the issues of time and family, I think, also. But
yeah, well, it's been satisfying, you know, up till now. It's been a lot of fun to be able to do both and to mm-hmm. combine both. But there's some people that really are, you know, really impressive to me.
Who? Again, if we could maybe, if you don't want to, won't be reading this, I suppose.
Different people. There's a guy named Gary Brodeur, who's at University of, it's University of Washington, St. Louis.
Right.
Who's a pediatric oncologist, and he does research on a pediatric tumor called neuroblastoma. Mm-hmm. And he does both very well. He's really respected as a clinician. The work that he does in the lab has come to clinical applicability. I mean, it actually has it does actually have a major impact on what happens in the clinic.
How long would you say
he
worked on that?
He got that satisfaction.
How long would he do? Would you say that he had to work on that stuff in the lab to have it come out, or is it just it was 2 years? He was really lucky.
I'd say he was pretty lucky. Probably only a matter of years. You know, where it obviously had a clinical impact.
Mm-hmm. And he had a vision. I mean, he made this happen in 2 years. We say luck, but or do you think there was more work done on, let's say, nerve cells as opposed to the kinds of tissues or blood cells that you were looking at and things like that?
Well, you know, he was lucky that he was working on the right gene that turned out to be an important one. Mm-hmm. But he was also smart enough to pick up on early clues that this was the right thing to be working on. But he's been able to, you know, to successfully do, you know, what I would call two jobs. As well as he's a fantastically interesting person that has a fantastic family life as well in St. Louis. And so, you know, there are people that can do it. Mm-hmm. Quite a few people that can do it, and they're you know, we're lucky to have them around. And there'll be more.
I guess I get a sense that maybe with the Pew, getting the Pew and being selected for it and going through the and doing it, and then a lot of the research that you indeed did, that you feel that you've tried to do this and it's not something you feel you can do, or maybe we need to find out it's something you don't feel you want to do.
Yeah, well, the immediate satisfaction isn't there, so that, you know, that's you know, one reason why.
Right, yeah.
I'd like to shift to one area which I know is very satisfying to me, which is clinical.
Mm-hmm.
The things that I've been working on didn't give a clinical satisfaction within 2 to 5 years, like maybe Gary Rodeur's work did.
You see, as you just said, I think before you see another decade or so worth of work before there might be some sort of
right.
direct applicability between that kind of basic research and clinical practice.
Right. So, you know, it's just the nature of what I'm, you know, the work that I'm doing compared to some other people. And the fact is that it's not just what I've done in my lab, it's other labs that are working on chromosome abnormalities and leukemia as well. I don't see there either the direct effect on practice yet.
No, and reading the literature that you gave me, neither do I. I mean, it does seem to be still quite a ways away. And indeed, these are maybe at best you've got markers now for understanding. You know, in the past 2 decades of work into oncogenes and into the relation between viral genes and the other eukaryotic genes and cancer has been pretty much worked out in a basic laboratory, you know, basic research way. But that's what you've got now. Is it's almost as if you've done some sort of something like Linnaeus would say you're supposed to do in biology, which is categorize and define. And now the next step, which does seem to be a very long stairway, has yet to come. And I also found it, of course, fascinating. I don't mean just in some sort of like intellectual way of oh, we get to read this, but just I think the depth of understanding about what's going on a cellular and on a genetic level with the development of something like cancer cells in the system and things like that. And would you say that kind of knowledge helps you in a clinical setting? Just even the knowledge, just the...
I'd hate to say no. I mean, I'd say...
I think so.
Mm-hmm. It keeps you, you know, wondering what's going on in any individual patient. Now, whether that actually helps the patient, I'd say probably not, but it certainly helps you, you know, keep up your own interest in everything that's going on in the patient. And sometimes we, you know, come up with things on the ward with the patients where you see something a little strange and maybe it fits with mm-hmm. something going on in the lab, and you want to check it out, and occasionally it becomes interesting.
I guess what I would like to spend some time on before we move back to the recent, let's say, post-Pew scholarship things. I assume you were married before the Pew funding ran out, but we talked a little bit briefly up tape about your kind of giving up the lab in a sense of day-to-day work. You help oversee it, but there are people doing the work. And you're just offering, I think, advice and suggestions and keeping track of what's going on because, of course, you do know a lot about it. But I would like to kind of cover some of what you've done over the past, I guess we'd say 5 years, and what kind of research you got into once you got out of the training, out of the fellowship here and into the mainstream academic, if you want. We're coming to the end of this side, so why don't we turn it over to you.